The first half of the 20th century in America featured a pitched battle between those who resolved to defend the fundamentals of the Christian faith and those who had repudiated them. In the major Protestant denominations, there was a struggle to determine within the denominations which of those sides would be dominant. Sadly, in far too many cases, the repudiators of the fundamentals of the faith were succeeding in removing the defenders from any real place of influence. The mainline Protestant denominations were drifting farther and farther from the historic positions that had been adopted in the wake of the Protestant Reformation. But among those who were trying to conserve those positions, a difference began to emerge as 1950 approached. There were some who did not want to be saddled, they said, with the designation of being fundamentalists, because they did not like the suggestion that they were somehow theologically illiterate. And that's what was assumed about fundamentalists. Beyond that, they wanted some kind of mechanism to promote what came to be a catchphrase in the latter part of the century, cooperation without compromise. The Federal Council of Churches had come into existence early in the 20th century, and it provided an ecumenical organization for mainline denominations. But its basis of fellowship was very loose, and almost anyone who would profess to believe in God of some kind would be accepted in the Federal Council of Churches. You did not have to agree to any particular creed or confession. In 1941, and let us remember that was the year in which our nation was brought into the Second World War, in 1941, a number of fundamentalist preachers and churches decided that there needed to be an organization in response to the Federal Council of Churches. And so in that year, they launched the American Council of Christian Churches, known by its acronym as the ACCC. But there were others who shunned the fundamentalist label, some of whom had their roots in the old-style Pentecostal movement, and they preferred to call themselves evangelicals to distinguish themselves from those illiterate fundamentalists. And in 1942, they formed a new organization that they called the National Association of Evangelicals, known again by its initials as the NAE, not to be confused with the NEA, as it was in one thing I read in doing research for this message. Initially, in the NAE, there were some fundamentalist leaders, but by 1947, as the direction of this organization became increasingly clear, the fundamentalists who had joined it initially resigned from it. That was a significant year because it was the year in which Harold Ockingay, who was the pastor of Park Street Baptist Church in Boston, just off the Boston Common, in which that year was the year in which he called for what he styled a new evangelicalism that would provide a sharp contrast to the old evangelicalism, that old form of separatism practiced by the fundamentalists. The new evangelicalism called for dialogue, not confrontation, with those who were liberals and modernists. Akinge's impact on the development of the NAE proved to be profound. And the judgment of the fundamentalists in departing from the organization proved to be correct. Historically, the NAE has tried to present itself as the guardian of the gospel heritage in the United States especially. It has tended to emphasize cooperative ventures and has tried to take the edge off doctrinal positions that would tend to divide people from each other. Now, over the years, that approach has continued to dilute the insistence of the NAE's leadership that it remains true to its statement of faith. They say, well, we still require anybody who joins our organization to subscribe or to agree to our statement of faith. But increasingly, the organization has become dominated by charismatic denominations like the Assemblies of God. It's one of the major groups in the NAE now. And parachurch ministries like Promise Keepers and others. They have become more and more prominent in the NAE, and they have tended to exert more influence. Not all the NAE members have necessarily agreed with the organization's leadership on the influence being exerted by others. But so far, few or none have severed their ties with the NAE, despite threats to do so. In 2001, at the NAE's 60th annual national convention, disagreement broke out into the open. The newly inaugurated president of the NAE was a man named Kevin Manoia, and he decided that it would be good if entire denominations that held membership in the national and world councils of churches could also be received into the NAE. And that represented a very sharp departure from their past policy. Individuals and individual churches that were in the World Council or the National Council had always been received into the NAE, but never entire denominations. One of the member denominations, of which there are, I think, 27 altogether, and a number of other bodies as well, but one of the member denominations, the Presbyterian Church of America, the PCA as it is called, protested strongly against that change in policy and threatened to secede from the NAE. The aim of Dr. Manoia's action was to bring the Reformed Church in America into full membership in the NAE. Now, if you don't know what the Reformed Church in America is about, all I have to do is say the name Robert Schuller. He is a minister in the Reformed Church in America. He pastors, of course, the famous Crystal Cathedral in Garden Grove, California. So it was to receive that group and people of the ilk of Robert Schuller that this proposed change was suggested. Well, there was a tremendous uproar within the organization. And eventually, the board of the NAE accepted Dr. Minoya's resignation from the presidency and rescinded all his actions. But due to the uproar, no convention was held last year on the 60th anniversary of the organization's founding. So for the first 60 years, a convention had been held every single year, even during World War II in their early years. But such was the uproar that they were not able to hold one last year. Early in March of this year, the 61st convention, no longer an annual convention, the 61st convention was held in Eden Park, Minnesota, at what is called the Wooddale Church. At the close of that meeting, a new president was chosen for the organization. He is Ted Haggard, a charismatic, the senior pastor of the New Life Church in Colorado Springs, a church that is in the process of building a 12,000-seat sanctuary near the Air Force Academy in Colorado Springs. 12,000 seats. Well, if they design it in the right way, they might be able to hold athletic events there. But that's what they're doing. Haggard announced that the 2004 convention of the NAE would be held at that church. And that, he said with great delight, it would feature as one of the main speakers, Dr. Robert Schuller. The convention, he said, will have an emphasis on mega churches in the United States, and Robert Schuller, as the pastor of one of the most visible such churches, will, of course, be listened to very keenly. What Haggard did not say in his announcement was that Robert Schuller is not in accord with the NAE's statement of faith. He is a universalist. He is an apostate. He debunks many of the fundamental tenets of the Christian faith. In an interview that Robert Schuller conducted with Billy Graham on May 31, 1997, Schuller was pleasantly surprised to discover that he and Graham shared the same views on universal salvation. That is, they both agreed that people not only could but would be saved without any knowledge of Christ or any knowledge of Scripture. If they followed the light they had, even if it was in a Buddhist temple, then they would be in heaven. That's what Billy Graham believes. You can judge by that whether or not he has any witness of the Spirit of God in his heart. But here then is Robert Schuller, the man who was so delighted to learn this news. Here then is the man whom the NAE has announced it will welcome as one of its main speakers next March at its national convention in Colorado Springs. And while the official overture to churches in the national and world councils has been withdrawn, there is more and more cooperation between the NAE and those groups taking place right across the board. And more cooperation as well between the NAE and certain Roman Catholic agencies. It's all in the name of relevance. Being socially relevant. It's all in the name of overcoming society's ills. Why can't we all work together? And for such reasons, the NAE has continued to water down its already weak stand and to draw closer and closer to those who have expressed their desire to see the Reformation reversed and the union of Christendom restored. There can be no doubt that we have a fitting designation for these compromisers when we call them the NAE subverters of the Reformation. We have read this evening from 2 Timothy chapter 3, and the words of Holy Scripture in this passage warn us most solemnly against the spirit of an apostate age. Those who are described in these verses by various forms of behavior do not, as we find, pass themselves off as wanton pagans. Their behavior may be pagan, but they do not present themselves in that way. Instead, they parade themselves as being among the religious. For we find in verse 5 that they are summed up as having a form of godliness. They know ritual in the contemporary style. They know when to clap, when to raise their hands, when to dance in the aisles, and when to embrace each other. They can sing the same mindless ditties over and over again and pretend that in doing so, they are praising the Lord. They have the jargon down. But the problem, Paul said, is that while they have the form of godliness, they deny the power of godliness. They don't want that kind of reality. They want to be accepted by the masses. It was quite interesting in reading this book that I've been reading to find the assessment again and again that Billy Graham's approach to mass evangelism was a calculated approach that he knew would bring him huge ways of reaching other people. It would bring him the approval of many people that he needed, many powerful and influential people that he needed to have if he wanted to see success according to the typical way of evaluating it, how many people are coming forward. And yet, even in that, there was a great irony for those who were led to believe that he would provide many, many new converts for their churches, soon came to find out that most of the people who went forward in his meetings were already church members, and those who were not were never heard from again. They want that acceptation. They want popularity. But they don't want the truth. They can't deal with the truth. And what is to be the attitude of the people of God toward them, we find in this passage? Are they to seek to enter into agreements with them? Are they to seek for grounds on which they can cooperate with them? No. Paul said very simply in verse 5, from such turn away. From such. From those who have a form of godliness, but who deny the power thereof, and who are marked by being lovers of their own selves, and on down the list, turn away. Now I ask this evening, when has the NAE followed this scriptural admonition? I'm very glad that the PCA found something in the swamp of compromise in which it has been involved, against which to protest. But I have to ask, why are they still allied with this organization? Is it because the PCA knows that it is already heavily involved in its own compromise? The PCA, in its General Assembly, has publicly endorsed the participation of its Covenant College choir in a Roman Catholic Mass during a recent European tour. Oh, it was said they were just singing a beautiful sacred number, but it was part of the Mass. What about the Reformed Presbyterian Church? It holds membership in the NAE. And I have to ask, why? Why are they party to that which is subverting the very idea for which they profess to stand of Christ's crown and covenant? Well, this evening, I want us to examine the NAE and resolve that we will continue to take our stand against an organization that has yet to take any stand against the notorious document, Evangelicals and Catholics Together. In fact, many of the NAE members were instrumental in bringing that document to pass. The entire approach of the NAE is built on the theme of accommodation. And we want to think of that theme in four ways. First of all, the principle of accommodation. From the outset, the NAE has followed what it calls the approach of cooperation without compromise. Now that sounds very good on the surface. Evangelicals working alongside other evangelicals or even non-evangelicals without surrendering any of their beliefs, cooperating with them without compromising anything. But the reality is that the so-called new evangelicalism requires for this cooperation a seeking of common ground between evangelicals and other evangelicals and evangelicals and non-evangelicals. When Billy Graham has been criticized for engaging in crusades that are sponsored by those who deny the gospel he claims to be preaching, his response has been that he is not the one who is compromising. Instead, he said, the liberals are compromising their views by sponsoring him, knowing what he was going to preach. But are they really compromising their views? Michael Ramsay was the Archbishop of Canterbury during the 1960s. And he was one who denied openly several of the major doctrines of Christian orthodoxy. And yet, he professed himself happy to cooperate with Graham in his crusades in England because he told his fellows in the Church of England, we are going to gain new people in our churches through Graham's crusade because by sponsoring that crusade, they would be in line for a certain percentage of those who came forward in the meetings. And the ominous aspect of that is that there were Roman Catholic priests who were helping to sponsor the Crusades, so that some people were directed to Roman Catholic churches. So Ramsay's point was, we can get these new people in our churches, and then we can teach them what he said was the right theology, once we get them. The principle of the accommodation, you see, is that by cooperating with non-evangelicals like Robert Schuller, they will bring those non-evangelicals to a more evangelical position. This is what they say they're doing. But nothing like that has ever happened. Why? The voice of Scripture is very clear. As we read in 2 Timothy 3, you are to turn away from them. If you turn to Romans chapter 16, Romans chapter 16 and verse 17. Now I beseech you, brethren, mark them which cause divisions and offenses contrary, notice this, to the doctrine which ye have learned, and avoid them. Notice that Paul puts that on the ground of the doctrine. He's saying if you have somebody who is teaching in contradiction to the doctrine, avoid that person. Let's turn to 2 Thessalonians and to chapter 3. 2 Thessalonians chapter 3. And look at verse 6. Now we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that ye withdraw yourselves from every brother that walketh disorderly, and not after the tradition which he received of us. Now, in the context, that has to do with the disorder of people not willing to work for what they eat. Paul said, if any man will not work, then he shall not eat. He said, they wrought themselves for their own bread. But in a wider context, he's speaking about anybody that has disorderliness in his life. And that goes beyond doctrine to other areas as well. And what was his counsel? Withdraw yourself from them. Now, that counsel is ridiculed by the members of the NAE and New Evangelicals at large as extreme come-outism. So when they can't respond to the argument, then they bring that up. Oh, that's just another example of this extreme come-outism. Well, the Bible does say, does it not, come out from among them and be ye separate. So if they want to tar me with being an extreme come-outist, well, I'll have to plead guilty to that. But the danger of this principle, the principle is, if we cooperate with them, we will influence them to believe more the way we believe, to become more conservative, more evangelical. That's the principle, but the danger of it is seen in the way in which it has worked itself out. And that's the second thing we find, the practice of accommodation. And here we have nothing more effective that we can do than to take the words of some of the speakers at this year's NAE convention in Minnesota. Now, you know that Dr. Colas was here earlier this year as a part of an effort to cover a Promise Keepers meeting here in Phoenix. Dr. Colas went from here to Minnesota, where he attended the NAE convention. And so we have his reporting on which to rely for what took place there. And I can tell you his reports are very thorough. But the attitude of the speakers at that convention demonstrates that the practical result of the principle of accommodation leads to utter confusion. For example, one of the speakers at the NAE convention was Dr. Martin Marty. Dr. Marty is a lecturer at Chicago Divinity School, one of the most apostate places you can ever find. He is also the editor of the very liberal magazine, Christian Century. He belongs to the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, a denomination that holds membership in the National Council and the World Council of Churches. So he was one of the speakers. You have to ask, what in the world is he doing speaking at the NAE? But he told the convention, many evangelicals now recognize they can work with, and notice how he puts this, the Roman Catholic Church on certain causes. Not Roman Catholic people or Roman Catholic agencies, but the Roman Catholic Church. He went on to say, evangelicals have learned from the mistakes of others who refuse to do this. That's speaking about people like you and me. He went on to say, as an illustration, many years ago, evangelicals rejected Christian rock, but now they embrace it. Well, what does that prove? All that proves is that the evangelicals abandoned their convictions. And if they're in the NAE, that's what they're going to do over and over again. Another one of the speakers was Dr. David Neff, editor of the New Evangelicalism's leading publication, Christianity Today. He said, "Evangelicalism is full of change." I don't regard that as a very comforting assessment. He went on to say, "We must transform sinful culture, not just reject it." Well, I'm not sure what he means by that, but I think that he means by that, let's take the sinful culture and let's, like somebody searching through a garbage can, let's sort out the things that we think we can work with or eat, and let's eat those and discard the rest. He went on to say, churches and parachurch organizations must partner together even more. He means as in the Promise Keepers. And then he said, this is the editor of Christianity Today. This was the magazine that was founded to promote the new evangelicalism. He said, "The need for cooperation never goes away. The evangelical Catholic together found a lot in common with conservative Roman Catholics." And I think by conservative Roman Catholics, we have to assume he means those who are doctrinaire. That is, those who are ardently Roman Catholics. Those who are the most opposed to the Reformation ever having taken place. So here, we see how the principle of accommodation works out in practice. Those who imagine that the organizations with whom they partner will meet them halfway have showed just how much they presume. And that is the next point to which we come, the presumption of accommodation. These people in the NAE really believe that there is such a thing as a halfway meeting point. They really believe that if they move toward Robert Schuller's position, he will reciprocate by moving toward theirs. But when we look at the scriptures, we find example after example after example that shows us that nothing like that happens. And I think undoubtedly the leading example in scripture of this presumption is to be found in the compromise between Ahab and Jehoshaphat. So let us turn to 2 Chronicles. 2 Chronicles, and the story is recorded in chapters 18 and 19. Chapter 18 begins with the statement, "Now Jehoshaphat had riches and honor in abundance and joined affinity with Ahab." After 3 or 4 years of conflict, suddenly they entered into an alliance. Now, I don't have time to go through all the details of that alliance, but suffice it to say, it was through that alliance that the wickedness of Ahab and Jezebel and their family was introduced into the kingdom of Judah. Jehoshaphat and Ahab entered into an alliance, and the alliance required that they combine their forces in a war against the Syrians. And you remember, of course, that Ahab wanted a prophet of the Lord, or Jehoshaphat wanted a prophet of the Lord. And Ahab said, we have all these prophets. And they all came in and said, "You're going to prosper, you're going to win, go ahead." And Jehoshaphat said, "Wait, these are all the prophets of Baal. Aren't there any prophets of the Lord here?" And Ahab said, "Well, there's one man, but I don't like him. He never says anything good about me. That's Micaiah. And he's such a bad fellow, I have him in prison. So Jehoshaphat said, oh, don't let the king say anything like that. Let's bring him up here and see what he has to say. So they brought him up, and he was told now, look, everybody else, all of the other prophets are saying, go ahead and prosper. So look, why don't you, this one time, you just agree with everybody else. And Micaiah's word was, what the Lord tells me to say, that's what I'm going to say. So he got up before Ahab, and Ahab said, well, do you have any word from the Lord? And he said, oh, go up and prosper. The Lord is going to deliver Syria to your hands. And Ahab knew that he was being mocked, and he said, I want you to tell me the truth, nothing but the truth. So he said, all right, I'll tell you what the truth is. You're going to be killed. And Ahab said to Jehoshaphat, see what I told you? He never says anything good about me. So they go up to the battle. And Ahab says to Jehoshaphat, all right, we're allies in the battle. I'm going to put on a soldier's uniform. And I'm just going to blend in with the troops. But you keep on your robes. See, Ahab had more confidence in what the prophet said than Jehoshaphat did. Where was Jehoshaphat's mind? I have no idea. And Jehoshaphat said, well, all right, sure, that sounds like a good plan. Into the battle they go. Ahab disappears. And the captain of the army of Syria said, look, you don't fight with anybody except the king of Israel. And of course, you'll be able to tell who he is. He'll have his royal robes on. So they saw Jehoshaphat. They said, that must be him. So they turned aside to fight with him, and suddenly Jehoshaphat realized, wait a minute, I've been set up. I think he would have thought of that before. He thought that by entering into this alliance with Ahab, that they would meet each other halfway, that he would influence Ahab to be a better person. And he found out at the last possible moment that it hadn't worked out that way at all. And then the Lord intervened. And though Ahab had tried to disguise himself, the Lord guided an arrow from a Syrian soldier, shot at no particular target. He just let it fly, and the Lord guided that arrow to Ahab. Then Jehoshaphat went home. And look at chapter 19 and verse 1. And Jehoshaphat, the king of Judah, returned to his house in peace to Jerusalem. Boy, don't you think that he was counting himself blessed to have gotten away with his life? But then a prophet comes out to meet him. And Jehu, the son of Hanani, the seer, went out to meet him and said to King Jehoshaphat, shouldest thou help the ungodly and love them that hate the Lord? Therefore is wrath upon thee from before the Lord. Jehoshaphat thought he would be doing something commendable by entering into this agreement with Ahab. But the message of the prophet to him was, you have presumed on that you ought not to presume on. You have loved those who hate the Lord. You have helped those who are ungodly. Those who, in the language of our passage in 2 Timothy, have a form of godliness, but who deny the power of it. And that presumption nearly got Jehoshaphat killed. And it resulted in the defeat of the army. The members of the NAE are presumptuous. They presume that their accommodation, what they call their cooperation without compromise, is really going to have the effect of bringing the liberals back into the evangelical fold. They're really going to come back. We're going to influence, and this is what our dialogue will do. And all the time they are helping the ungodly, loving those who hate the Lord. Instead, what they end up doing is drinking the appealing beverage of compromise. Because everybody likes compromisers, only to find out it is a beverage full of deadly poison. And that's the fourth thing I would point out to you, the poison of accommodation. The non-evangelicals never become like their evangelical fellows. The evangelicals always slide in the opposite direction. They always move toward the non-evangelicals. And here is the deadly poison. Here is why the NAE has consistently rejected the legacy of the Protestant Reformation. It cannot maintain a separatist position outside the camp of popular religion and still have the acceptance that it wants to have. So, the NAE looks for ways in which accommodations can be made. In spite of its long-standing motto, the NAE really features cooperation with compromise. Now, at the end of the day, what is really at stake here? I'll tell you. The souls of men and women, boys and girls, the purity of the gospel, the defense of the Holy Scriptures, the infallible Book of God, the exaltation of the Son of God as very God of very God and truly a man. These are not matters that are open to be debated in national conventions. These are things that are true and things to be proclaimed. Martin Lloyd-Jones was pastor for many years of Westminster Chapel in the city of London. And the New Evangelical Movement, and Billy Graham in particular, sought to make use of Martin Lloyd-Jones in 1966, in October again of that year, in what was called an Evangelical Alliance. Martin Lloyd-Jones warned, to the dismay of many new evangelicals, "I argue that people who do not believe the essentials of the faith, the things that are essential to salvation, cannot be guilty of schism. They are not in the church." You could almost hear the shock. He went on to say, "If you do not believe a certain irreducible minimum, you cannot be a Christian. And you are not in the church." That applied to Michael Ramsay, the Archbishop of Canterbury. He went on to ask, "Have we reached a time when one must not say a thing like that? Have evangelicals so changed that we no longer make an assertion like that?" He went on to say that what we should be asking is not, "How can we get along with each other?" but, "What is a Christian?" He said we should be asking, "How is a person to be saved? What is the church?" Because he said those are the questions that separate the wheat from the chaff when it comes to theology. Billy Graham had a meeting with Martin Lloyd-Jones, I believe it was in 1963, if my memory serves me correctly on this detail, in which he asked Lloyd-Jones if he would chair a meeting on evangelism. And Lloyd-Jones said to him, they had this conversation in the entry of the Westminster Chapel, he said, "If you will drop your sponsorship from Roman Catholics and non-believers, then I will chair your meeting. I think he also mentioned, if you will drop your invitation system, meaning the way he approached his mass evangelistic techniques, said, then I will chair your meeting. So he said, we can talk about what true evangelism is. Graham would not accept those conditions because he was more concerned to have the acceptance of infidels and papists than he was concerned with the truth of the Scriptures. That is what I mean by subverting the Reformation. What is the message for us? Well, the question is, how much do you love Christ? How much do you love His Word? How much do you love His Church? Because the Reformation was about those things. So the challenge is, let us defend the Reformation and not seek to subvert it, not seek to counteract it, to neutralize it. I tell you that in these days, more and more, there is an emphasis on subverting it. Let us not be found among that number. But let us heed the admonition of the Apostle Paul. Let us know that we are in those perilous times of which he spoke. And let us resolve that from these who have a form of godliness, but who deny the power thereof, we will turn away.